The following is a sermon from Haven Heights Baptist Church in Wauseon. At Haven Heights, we believe that faith comes through hearing, and hearing through the word of Christ. As you listen to the sermon, we pray the Lord would use the preaching of his word to point you to Jesus and to strengthen your faith in him. If you're looking for a church home, we'd love for you to join us on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. For more information about our church, go to havenheightsbaptist.org or find us on Facebook. Our nation's capital is named after George Washington. We have a state named after Washington. 43 cities are named after Washington. 12 colleges bear his names, and countless high schools, roads, bridges all have the name Washington. Our country remembers George Washington as the most influential leader we have ever had. Billy Graham was a spiritual advisor to every president from Truman to President Obama. Billy Graham preached to the masses, preached to more than 215 million people. His show was on 66 different countries and on over 700 radio stations. Our nation's greatest leader was George Washington. Our nation's greatest spiritual leader was Billy Graham. Now consider what it'd be like if those two men were one in the same. Imagine what it'd be like if the same person was the greatest leader and also the greatest preacher. If we were to imagine such a figure, we would begin to scratch the surface of how the Jewish people understood the person of Moses. For the Jewish people, there was no one like Moses. No one else had his power, his influence, his ministry. And not without reason. Consider what Moses did for the Jewish people. Moses led the people out of slavery. Moses is the one who went to Pharaoh and said, "Let my people go." And then Moses administered the plagues. Moses led the people of God to the promised land. He wrote the first five books of the Bible. And yet of all the things Moses did, there are two acts that stand above the rest. The first is manna in the wilderness. The people of God are in the wilderness. There is no food. They're near death. They are literally famished. Moses cries out to God and then miraculously feeds them with bread from heaven. The second thing that Moses does that stands above the rest is the crossing of the sea. The enemies of God's people are chasing after God's people. The people of God get to the sea. Their backs are against the water. There's nowhere to go. They're about to be destroyed. But then Moses sticks his staff out over the water. The sea opens up. The people of God walk through as though on dry ground. Now, why does any of this matter for our sermon today? It matters because in Deuteronomy chapter 18, the Bible says the Lord will raise up a prophet like Moses. John chapter 6 shows us that Jesus is the prophet who is like Moses, the prophet who does the same miracles as Moses. And so we began to study that last week. The crowd is in the wilderness, and just like the crowd before, they're famished, and just like the crowd before, they're about to die, and just like the crowd before, this crowd is miraculously fed with bread. And now this week comes the crossing of the sea. And Jesus, just like Moses, will cross the sea as though walking on dry ground. We see this in John chapter 6. If you have your Bible, I invite you to turn there. And we'll begin in verse 16. When evening came, his disciples went down to the lake, where they got into a boat and set off across the lake of Capernaum. By now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. A strong wind was blowing, and the waters grew rough. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water, and they were frightened. And he said to them, "It is I, do not be afraid." Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. The next day, the crowd that had stayed on the opposite shore of the lake realized that only one of the boat has been there and that Jesus had not entered it with his disciples, but they had gone away alone. Then some boats from Tiberias landed near the place where the people had eaten the bread after the Lord had given thanks. Once the crowd realized that neither Jesus nor his disciples were there, they got into the boats and went to Capernaum in search of Jesus. In John chapter 6, Jesus does the same miracles. So he feeds them with bread and he crosses the sea. He does the same miracles as Moses and yet does them better. The main point this morning is this: Jesus is the new and better Moses. Two questions then to guide our time. Number one, how is Jesus the new Moses? And then number two, how is Jesus the better Moses? So number one, how is Jesus the new Moses? And we're asking the question, how is Jesus like Moses? How are they similar? In our text this morning, Jesus crosses the Sea of Galilee, and just like Moses before, Jesus crosses the sea as if walking on dry ground. Verse 16, Jesus goes down to the water's edge. He puts his disciples into the boat. He tells them to cross the sea and then says, I will meet you on the other side. The disciples get in the boat. They raise the sails. The wind comes up. The disciples row for hours and they get nowhere. And then Jesus comes walking on the water. Jesus, just like Moses, crosses the sea as though walking on dry ground. And when we look at the details of the account in depth, we find that the miracle of Jesus is nearly identical to the miracle of Moses. Verse 16, Jesus puts his disciples ahead of them. Jesus is their leader. Jesus is always out front leading them. But this time, Jesus puts them ahead of him, and Jesus goes behind them. God was leading the Israelites with a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day. God was always out in front of them. But before they crossed the sea, if you remember, God goes behind them and puts the people of God in front of him. And then God sends a strong wind to split the sea. Verse 18, a strong wind is blowing. The people of God wait all night as the wind blows. The disciples are waiting all night as the wind blows. The people of God are scared to death. They hear the Egyptians coming and they think the Egyptian army is going to destroy us. The disciples are scared to death. They hear the wind and the waves. They think the sea will destroy them. And then comes the miracle. God splits the sea. Moses miraculously crosses the sea as though walking on dry ground. And then the miracle. There is Jesus walking on the water as if it's ground. Now we see the similarities and we ask the question, but how is this better? Because that's part of the deal, right? Not only is Jesus supposed to be like Moses, he's supposed to be better than Moses. And so we ask, where is this better? We see that Jesus is a prophet who's like Moses, check. Feeding the 5,000, check. Walking across the waters on dry ground, check. But where's that better? Don't quite see it. Now, last week we saw it with great clarity, right? Jesus fed the people miraculously with bread, just like Moses. Moses miraculously feeds the people with bread. Jesus miraculously feeds the people with bread, and that was all the same. But there was one noticeable difference. When Moses brought the bread from heaven, he had them gather as much as they wanted. Those who gathered much had enough. Those who gathered little had enough. Everyone had enough. But no one had too much. When Jesus fed them, not only were they satisfied, there was an abundance. The disciples pick up 12 basketfuls of leftover bread. And that's the point. The bread that Jesus provides is abundant. Moses provides enough. Jesus provides more than enough. So back to this week. What happens in the crossing of the sea? What happens when Jesus does this that it's more than Moses? And if we ask, because if we're honest, this actually seems less impressive. Jesus' miraculous crossing here was less distance. Probably about 6 miles to cross the Sea of Galilee. The crossing of the Red Sea was at least 11 miles, maybe more. Jesus' crossing was less people. 12 disciples crossed the sea. Moses led maybe 600,000 people across the Red Sea. And at first take, it seems less impressive than Moses. And so we ask, how can Jesus be the better Moses? That's our second question. How is Jesus better than Moses? This miracle is better because in the miracle, the disciples see the divine. In the crossing of the Red Sea, the Israelites see the power of God. But in the crossing of the Sea of Galilee, the disciples actually see God. And there is a difference. There's a difference between seeing the power of God and actually seeing God. Look at verse 19. The disciples are frightened. And that little phrase is absolutely incredible because verse 19 tells us that the disciples were afraid when Jesus shows up. The other gospels tell us that the disciples were afraid of the storm. And the other gospels tell us that the disciples honestly thought they were going to drown. But John tells us that they don't become afraid until Jesus shows up. And that's the complete opposite of what we would expect. We would expect the disciples to see Jesus, and we expect them to say, "Oh, I'm so glad you are finally here. We were so worried we were going to drown, but now that you're here, now we know that we're going to be safe and that we're going to live." But it's not like that at all. It's actually when they know that it's Jesus on the water. It's verse 20 when Jesus says, "It is I." That's when they're terrified. In the 1950s, the British government had this great idea to let some of their navy experience an atomic bomb. And so they positioned a group of ships near where the atomic bomb was going to be exploded. And the sailors were supposed to be the closest people ever to witness an atomic blast. Supposed to be the closest people ever without being harmed, at least. And so the day of the explosion, each captain briefs his sailors. And he says, "Okay, the bomb's going to go off over there, and we're going to count down from 10. And by the time we get to 10, you need to close your eyes. You need to get your arm over your eyes. And then with your other arm, you need to hold on to the railing or hold on to something solid." The bomb goes off, and those who saw the explosion describe the scene like this. They said the flash of light was so bright that they could see right through their eyelids. They could see into their arm, and they saw their bones and their blood vessels, and they even saw the man in front of them. And they said the blast was so violent that some who were holding on to railings broke arms and legs. And then they said, every sailor did the same thing afterwards. They curled up in a fetal position and screamed and cried. The sailor saw something so indescribable, something so incredibly powerful, that it terrified them beyond any human understanding. And so there's nothing left to do except to scream in terror. That's what happens here. The disciples are on the lake, and the storm comes up. And from the other accounts, it's probably the most powerful storm they've ever seen. And then they see something more powerful than that. They see Jesus walking along as if it's nothing. And they realize this Jesus is not impacted by the storm. He's over the storm. And these disciples see the same thing the British sailors saw, something that is so indescribable, so incredibly powerful, they're terrified, and there's nothing left to do except scream and yell. And when Jesus says, verse 20, "It is I," that does nothing to relieve their fears. When Jesus says, "It is I," that actually elevates their fear, that actually makes them more fearful, and that's what causes them this terror. When Jesus says, "It is I," it causes them even more terror, because that's not what Jesus said. Jesus said two words, "I am." And the disciples knew exactly what Jesus meant. They know that when Moses saw God in the burning bush, God calls himself the great I am. And Jesus says, "That's me. I am the great I am." Jesus says, "I am the God of Moses. I am the God of all power." And here's what they know. They know the great I am sent the plagues. And they know the great I am punishes sin. They know that they are sinners and that this God is holy. And they know, it's real simple, they know that those who belong to God walked through the sea on dry ground, and they know those who were God's enemies were drowned. And they say, "Oh my goodness, there is God walking through the sea as though on dry ground, and here I am drowning. Where do I stand with him? Am I his person or am I his enemy?" Do you know how a storm is formed? A storm is formed by two competing forces. It's when cold air collides with warm air. And they can't coexist, and they want to be in the same spot, but they can't get along. So the cold air tries to go down, and the warm air tries to go up, and they're pushing against each other, and everything gets churned up, and now you have a storm. On the lake, two forces are colliding. God's power is colliding with man's sin. And that's the storm the disciples are most concerned about. God's holy, and I'm a sinner. And they realize this force of God's holiness and my force of sin, they cannot coexist. And they realize I'm in a storm. And that's the way it is for anyone who sees God. Think of Isaiah chapter 6. He sees the divine, he cries out, "Woe is me! I'm about to be ruined!" He's holy, and I'm not. Disciples here are screaming in fear, undoubtedly chanting over again, "Woe is me! Woe is me! Woe is me!" And it has nothing to do with the storm around them, and everything to do with the storm within them. They are in God's presence, and they know holy God can and holy God ought to destroy them for their sin. And that's what makes verse 20 so incredible. Jesus says, "Don't be afraid." And in the original, it's even better. It's just two words again. No fear. Jesus says, "I am. No fear." You know what a word of grace that was? The disciples are struggling at the oars over half of the night. Undoubtedly rowing so hard, they probably have injuries by this point. They're thinking that they're about to drown and about to go under. For hours, they call out to God for help, and God's nowhere to be found. And they surely think, you know, Jesus doesn't know about our problem and God doesn't care. And then when they see Jesus, they think, he's probably against me. Because he's walking on the water and I'm drowning on the water and I'm like the Egyptian army. I'm about to be covered by the sea. I'm about to go under. And then he says, "No fear." Several years ago, I was at a pastor's conference. Some 10,000 men gathered in a basketball arena. And the preacher of the hour is talking about suffering. And as he preaches about suffering, we can begin to hear one by one, pastor after pastor begin to cry. Some uncontrolled sobbing. And as he preaches on, it becomes obvious there's not a dry eye in the room. And he had one simple point. The Lord leads us into, and the Lord leads us through suffering so that we see him as the great I am. So that we see him as the one who has power over all. And so that we see him as the one who has power to deliver us. And that's what they see. They see him as the great I am. The one who is over the storm, the one who has power over all power, and yet, praise be to God, the one who is for them. The one who will not hold their sins against them. And the one who will lead them safely to the other side. Look at verse 21. The boat immediately reached the place where they were going. And that's a parable for the Christian life. Jesus is the great I am. He has power over every aspect of my life. And he brings the good. And sometimes he allows the bad. And he does it all so that we might see him as the great I am, the one who is over all. And because he's over all, sometimes he allows the trauma, the trial, and the temptation. And it's only so that we see him as he is, the God over all. And because he is over all, he ensures that his own will make it safely to the other side. So what are we to do? We'll end with some application, then we'll be through. Look at verse 22. The crowds began to search for Jesus. And the crowds recognized a couple things. They recognized we need Jesus. So Jesus has done a great miracle for them. He fed them with bread, and they realized we could use this guy. And so they look all over the land, and then they realize the disciples are gone, and the boats are gone, verse 24. So they decide they're going to cross the lake because they're desperate to find Jesus. There's a couple basic things here. Number one, Jesus is really powerful. Number two, we need him. And number three, we must find him. Now that seems like really obvious application, right? Jesus is really powerful. We need him, and so we got to find him. We got to go get him. But something is incredibly wrong with that formula. We see that in verse 15. They intended to make him a king by force. You see, these people knew their Bible. They know their history. They know the power that Moses had. And they know what Moses did with his power. They know that Moses led their ancestors to the promised land, the land of blessing and prosperity. And they see in Jesus an even greater power than Moses, and they think, if I can just get him to my side, he's going to take me to the place of prosperity and blessing. And so they have one goal in all of this. I got to get Jesus onto my side. And this happens all the time. It happens everywhere. And we do it as well. And we think, how can I get Jesus onto my side? It happens in sports. Teams pray. And teams post Bible verses on their feet and on their face. Just yesterday, a former football player posted this. Is it any coincidence that a vocal Christian is in the national championship game? Implication, If you have Jesus on your side, you will succeed. Politicians do this all the time. One side says Jesus is pro-choice and pro-trans. The other side says Jesus is pro-border and pro-guns. And they all say the same thing. Jesus is on our side. And still others will say, well, God told me. Because who can argue when God is on their side? And we ask the questions, right? Well, I mean, come on, preacher. Doesn't God speak to us? And can't we know which side God is on in some of those things? I mean, come on. And isn't it true that we should, you know, pray before big events? And shouldn't we think of Bible verses? Are these things not true? But it all misses the mark. Because the question is never, is Jesus on my side? The question is this, am I on his side? Have I aligned myself with him? If ever there was a person who thought Jesus was on his side, it was Joshua. And Joshua is the successor to Moses. And after Moses dies, God makes promise after promise after promise to Joshua. And this one day, Joshua is in a field and he's standing in front of the great city Jericho. And Jericho is a godless city and a wicked city. And the city of Jericho is literally the only thing that stands between the people of God and the promises of God. And as Joshua is staring at the city, off in the distance, he sees a man standing alone. And Joshua approaches the man, and as he gets real close, he sees the man has his sword ready for battle. Joshua goes up to the man, and Joshua says, "Are you on our side? Or are you on their side? You look ready to fight. Whose side are you on?" And the man says, "Neither." And when the man says neither, Joshua falls face down to the ground. And he realizes this man is God in the flesh. And he realizes the question is not, is God on my side? And he realizes there's only one thing that matters. Am I on his side? Have I aligned myself to him? That's it. Have I aligned myself with him? So what are we to do this hour? Turn to the Lord. Confess you are the great I am. You have power of all power. And because you are God, my life cannot be about me trying to get you to do my thing. My life has to be about me doing your thing. And because you have power of all power, and because I have aligned myself to your side, I now claim your word, no fear. And I believe that no matter what happens, no matter what I go through, I believe that you will keep me safe until you deliver me to the other side. You've been listening to a sermon from Haven Heights Baptist Church in Wauseon. If you're looking for a church home, we invite you to join us. We gather on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. For more information about our church, go to havenheightsbaptist.org or find us on Facebook.